everyone, and welcome back to another year, another semester of the Faculty of Horror, as always podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And yep, as most of you know, we did take August off and we are back now. And it feels really good to be back. It felt really good to take a month off, but I think we were both missing it by mid-August.
I definitely missed it, for sure.
We have so much stuff coming up through the rest of this year into next year for you guys. So we needed to be ready, rested, and able to do that. So we are going to skip our usual way of doing things and do one announcement right off the top. This is the last episode we are doing before we do our first ever live episode in Salem, Massachusetts, as part of Salem Horror Fest. And we couldn't be more excited. The festival kicks off on September 22nd, but we will be there the weekend of October 7th and 8th. Mm-hmm. And we've got some really fun stuff and screenings happening on the 7th. And then our live show on American Psycho is on October 8th. So we will leave all the links and everything in the episode show notes if you still need to get tickets or want to learn more about Salem Horror Fest, because it's a pretty great initiative and in its first year.
Yeah, we'd love to see you if you're in the area, or if you know Salem and you'd like to suggest a couple of places for us to visit. I imagine we will be on sensory overload the entire time. I am pumped.
I am so pumped. But before we go to America, before we talk about psychos in America, we need to talk about some homegrown psychos. We today are going to tackle something that has been kicking around between us for a long time. Mm-hmm. We've talked about doing this episode for a long time. And today we're going to talk about Vincenzo Natali's 1997 film, Cube.
I love this film. I am a huge fan of Vincenzo Natali, actually. If you guys are familiar with the Black Museum horror lecture series that I run out of Toronto, Vincenzo Natali was our very first lecturer. We weren't established. We were just an idea and a concept, and we had this ramshackle deal at a ramshackle cinema to throw this kind of event, but he gave us a shot. He thought it sounded cool, and he came out and he did an amazing job. And his lecture was about architecture and film. And, you know, he talked about Rosemary's Baby. He talked about a lot of horror films that have landmarks and where architecture plays a large role in the film itself. But he also showed us some behind the scenes concept sketches from Cube. He talked about Cube a little bit. And I was on cloud nine. I was so excited.
And I had never seen Cube up until a few weeks ago. It had been on my to watch list forever, mm-hmm. for so long. It was embarrassing. So as we are occasionally wont to do with the Faculty of Horror, we use it as an excuse to watch the movies we have been putting off for far too long. So I really enjoyed watching Cube, getting to spend time with it, thinking about it, and seeing what you can do with really independent film means.
Right.
And make something really iconic. And I think it's a really beloved cult classic, or a contemporary cult classic within horror and sci-fi.
Well, that's right. And if you've been listening to the Faculty of Horror for a long time, if you recall our episode on Shivers, we talked about the Canadian horror industry, the Canadian horror history of government intervention and how Canadian filmmakers are getting funding from the government to make these films, but the government's not so keen on horror. In the case of Cube, Vincenzo was able to mobilize a grant. He made a short film prior to making Cube called Elevated, which was made in 1996. I couldn't find it to watch it. It wasn't on YouTube. It wasn't anywhere. People were commenting on news groups and stuff that they saw it late at night on some like TV channel or something, and they loved it. And so I got an idea of what it was about. But basically, he wrote this short film to demonstrate his ability of what he wanted to do for Cube. And then the government financed it. And it turned out to be, as Alex said, a cult classic, an indie darling, great DVD sales, and two sequels, for better or for worse.
And to Andrea's point, I think it's interesting to talk about how Cube falls into the Canadian film history. Now, in prep for this episode, I revisited one of the Rumored Library books that I so happen to have on my bookshelf, which is James Burrell's Horrorwood North, which is all about Canadian horror films and is a ton of great interviews and pieces about so many different films. And there's an interview with Natali, and Burrell breaks out, you know, different periods within the Canadian film industry where these films appear. And this one falls into what he called the post-tax shelter years, which he dubbed from 1989 to 2009. So it's really pretty cool that Natalie was still able to get grants and funding and financing from government means, because that was really not happening in any real way. You know, the Canadian film industry is still all over the place, and the financing is all over the place, and they keep trying to make these prestige indie pictures with like an American kind of pseudo celeb, and it just never quite pans out. And I wish they would embrace the power of genre, because genre is not a bad word.
No,
it's not even a dirty word. It's a good word.
It can be a dirty word. Genre. What about when I say it like that?
No.
Nay. And Natalie has gone on to have a pretty prolific career. He still resides in Canada, as far as I know, but he went on to do Splice, which is a really interesting, fucked up film. That film made me deeply uncomfortable, and there are themes in that film that'll play into our discussion of Cube, I'm sure, but since then he has also worked on Hannibal, he's worked on American Gods, which is where I got an opportunity to talk to him earlier this year, and yeah, he's doing pretty well for himself, and he's one to watch going forward, as far as I'm concerned.
So without further ado, Andrea and I are going to knock ourselves out. We might wake up in the middle of a cube, I don't know. In any event, let's do it. Let's talk about Vincenzo Natali's Cube.
A cube.
26 rooms high. 26 rooms across.
17,576 rooms.
Anybody remember how they got here?
Why would they throw innocent people in here? Are we being punished?
There's a way in here, so there's got to be a way out.
Do you think they'd go to all the trouble to build this thing if we could just walk out?
Take a good long look around, because I got a feeling it's looking at us.
We have about 3 days without food and water before we're too weak to move.
I just want to wake up.
I looked into a room down there, and something almost cut my head off.
Motion detectors integrated into the walls. Tough to spot.
You're not getting out of here.
Yes, we are.
There is no way out of here.
We need to get around the trap.
They're identified by prime numbers.
We'll figure it out.
I can't.
I'm not dying in a rat maze.
No more talking. No more guessing. You gotta save yourselves from yourselves.
What the hell's going on?
We haven't been moving in circles. The rooms have.
We are the key.
The cube.
The film begins with a single man traversing a strange futuristic environment that's made up of cube-shaped rooms separated by a small hatch door on each side, as well as the ceiling and the floor. Suddenly, he enters a room and is killed by a deadly trap. Then we meet another five people who are also stuck in the same environment. The aggressive cop Quentin, the cynical architect Worth, the paranoid conspiracy theorist Holloway, mathematical student Levin, and Renz, an escape artist. The five people introduce themselves a bit awkwardly, but they're quick to understand their situation. All the rooms are identical except for their colors, and some are set with traps while others are safe. So as Levin busies herself with solving the numeric coordinates embedded on each of the hatch doors, the group encounters an autistic man with a knack for crunching numbers named Kazan, who they bring along with them. Tensions rise as the group gets increasingly hungry and frustrated by their inability to solve the numbers and escape the cube. The group shrinks little by little, sometimes from deadly traps and sometimes from personality clashes, until Kazan, the only survivor of the cube, enters a bright white light and an unknown fate. So the concept is simple. It's deceptively simple. And I've had a couple of opportunities to talk about Cube and to review Cube. I believe it was on my list, my Halloween list last year, wasn't it?
I believe it was.
High on concept, low on budget. Natalie had only constructed one complete cube, and then there was a partial one for when they were looking through the hatch at another cube. So yeah, this was made on a shoestring budget, but it relies heavily on the personalities and performances of the cast, which I think is so brilliant. And yet, when I was doing research on this movie, I was astonished to discover that opinions are quite divided about it.
Yeah, there are some people who love it. There are some people who hate it. I think this film probably suffers from a lot of overhyping. You know, if you haven't seen Cube, and everyone's like, oh, it's this great film, you should fucking watch it right now. And it really is. It's a dark, bleak horror drama about personalities and the lengths that you're pushed to when you're just confronted with yourself. And Natali has said in interviews, obviously, to Andrea's point, that he designed and kind of created this story based on the need to do one setup, one location, and then how can that change? Okay, color can change it. There can be different elements to it, but it all has to remain within this kind of one and a half sets. And as he was thinking about it, he realized this kind of like block box space would work really well. And then he wanted it to become a maze. And then how would it become a maze if it's blocks? Well, then it would be a cube. And, you know, so necessity is the mother of invention, so to speak. And in one of the interviews I was reading, he talked about how once he had that initial concept of these people waking up and having to go through all these trials and trying to figure something out about what this thing is, after that, with his co-screenwriters, it took them about 3 years to get the script to a point where it actually made sense in terms of personalities and character and like a three-act structure, because you have to kind of keep it interesting. And we've talked a bit about this on yet again one of our other Canadian horror film episodes in Pontypool. How do you shoot one location again and again and again with rising tension so it becomes interesting and you're not just watching a play with like a proscenium arch and everything? And I think he does a good job, but that's the thing about this movie. It is exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. It's not going to blow your mind in terms of, you know, concept or anything, but it might change some of your ideas if you let it. But yeah, I can see people getting frustrated that it didn't have more budget or reveals or anything. It really is a terrifying human drama.
Mm-hmm.
But for any discussion here on the Faculty of Horror, I think we need to start kind of at the ground floor. And when you think about Cube as a film, as a concept, it is a maze. And it's not just a maze, it's a labyrinth. Now, labyrinths have been around forever. They date back to the Neolithic Age, the Bronze Age. People track that through pottery, through cave paintings, all kinds of things. They were prominent in the Roman Empire, and they're mentioned in Shakespeare. There is no dearth of labyrinth metaphors, themes, imagery in popular culture, in art, in classical art. But labyrinths or mazes, as we know them, kind of became a leisure activity for like the quote-unquote middle classes back in the 19th century. And then they became an even bigger fixture of the leisure class or leisure activities in the 20th century, and they start popping up all over the place. And I mean, I remember, you know, me and my family would go to an amusement park or a hotel that was like kid-friendly. There would always be some kind of maze, and I used to love doing them. And of course, mazes and labyrinths are no stranger to horror. You know, one of the most famous ones is probably in The Shining. But for purposes today, and where I pulled on some of my theater background, was pulling in a little bit of Greek mythology. So for a lot of people, if you're, you know, so inclined, if you think of mazes and labyrinths, you might think of a fella named Theseus going up against a monster called the Minotaur. And the Minotaur was this, you know, bull-headed, part man, part animal beast that resided within this labyrinth. And, you know, it's a whole fucking Greek history, Real Housewives of Athens kind of backdrop going on in this story. But to summarize, Theseus goes to basically try to overcome this Minotaur in this maze and this labyrinth. And one of the princesses who's, you know, nearby falls for him, and her name is Ariadne. And she's also a very famous figure in Greek mythology. And Ariadne's like, Theseus, he is fine. So what she does is she says, okay, if you're going to do this, what you have to do is you have to go at night, and here's this ball of red string. We're going to pin this at the start of the labyrinth, and you're going to go through so you can track your way through. Fight the Minotaur, and if you fight and you win, then you have a way to get back out. And that's exactly what happens. He goes in, uses the string, fights the Minotaur, defeats it, comes back out via the red string, and he and Ariadne run off together, and he's like, baby, I'm going to marry you. This is going to be so amazing. And she's like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then he abandons her on a beach. But all that to say, there is a lot of scholarship about Theseus and the Minotaur and what the Minotaur could mean. And it's been appropriated in so many different theories. But kind of the overall thing about the Minotaur is that it represents the unknown or the subconscious. It's that thing that's always kind of dwelling there. And, you know, the Minotaur in this myth is known for taking a lot of lives, and it takes this one person to overcome it. And a lot of people associate Theseus with being the hero of the story, but in fact, as some people do, and I believe it as well, it's actually Ariadne who, you know, is the one who kind of comes up with the plan and gets him in and gets him out. And I think it actually speaks to some of the personalities at play within the cube. You know, as Andrea mentioned, we have Quentin, who is this kind of monstrous, hard figure within the cube. And, you know, he becomes the monster when he's running out of options. And then, in my opinion, it's kind of Levin who becomes the Ariadne figure, because she's the one who's able to figure out the prime numbers and the basic math stuff and tries to keep the group together. So, you know, there is a sense of someone being active and then someone being active to the point where they can't go any further. So they lash out, they destroy rather than create.
Yeah, the characters in this film, again, it goes back to the research I was doing. I love the characters. There's a lot of criticism that they are stock characters. They're pretty basic people. They're all very different in their own way. And they all have, you know, their own piece of the puzzle to contribute. And I like the way this film kind of, it gets on with it. You know, they're in this situation. They accept it pretty early on, and right away it becomes about problem solving, and they discover the numbers, and, you know, things kind of unspool from there. You've got these personalities who sometimes they check in and they're optimistic and they want to solve stuff. Sometimes they check out and give up. Sometimes they lash out. It all feels very human and very normal and very natural to me, which I think, in the context of this film, where the cube is a very sterile, mechanical, futuristic thing, to have such organic emotions and personalities running through it is what makes the film.
And another thing Natalie has said was that the cube is kind of a concept of hell, but he didn't want it to be any kind of classic representation of hell. It's a hell based in modernity. It's a hell based in, you know, the jumpsuits that they wear and the technology that surrounds them in the traps that kill them almost immediately and brutally. It's a very decisive kind of hell.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it as hell. I thought of it as life, where we're kind of thrown into this situation and we can agonize ourselves with the whys and wherefores. And there are certain personalities within this cube, as there are on this planet, where people are like, it has to mean this, it has to mean something. No, it doesn't mean anything. There's the nihilist, there's the fatalist. But the fact remains that we are in this environment and there is violence. People get killed senselessly. There's no making sense of it. You only have to survive it. It's perhaps pretty bleak.
Well, and I think what's really bold about this film is that it starts with no kind of conception of an outside world. We don't know what era it really takes place in. We don't know exactly where they are. There's very little outside of the cube to inform what happens within it. We have what the characters say, but, you know, everything is kind of a half-truth or part of their own viewpoint. Mm-hmm. So you can't really take anything for full credibility, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I think what also factors in, you know, like any kind of thing, like, you know, I like to talk about with zombies, you know, zombies in zombie films aren't usually the monster. It's the people who are the monster. Mm-hmm. And just kind of like that, there is no horrible Freddy Krueger-like thing living in the boiler room of the cube. There's no big bad. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like that. the alliances, your allegiance to the character. It's not linear. There is only kind of your gut reaction to every instance that they encounter. And I think what this film does well in terms of horror is create an atmosphere of dread. And it transitions because, as we've already talked about, initially the dread is about the traps. But they very quickly figure out what those traps are, and then it becomes about each other.
Mm-hmm.
The further they go, the longer they go. And I think Natalie and the team behind it really create this sense of time passing in a very short film.
Mm-hmm.
And the more the dread becomes increasingly palpable, the more they are forced to rely on each other. Like, that is when it just becomes like, oh shit, we're not just five people getting through what is essentially a really deadly escape room. We are now tied to each other, especially once they realize that, like, oh, she's really good at math. He's really good at crunching numbers. He was, you know, an amazing escape artist from a jail. Oh shit, he's dead. You know, once they kind of see the pieces they each have to play, it becomes harder to get rid of people or let them go. And I think you see that really explicitly. Like, that's when the film really took a turn for me. And I actually thought it was a pretty ballsy move of the film to, about, you know, halfway, a little more than halfway through the film, show the outside of the cube, that they could reach some kind of outside of the cube and see outside of it. And then you have that terrifying scene where Quentin kills Holloway.
He does, yeah. And his smile just slides off his face. It's a good moment. It's well done. Say what you want about the acting in this film. I remember that moment being harrowing.
Yeah. And it was something that I was just like, I felt like it was coming, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And then you feel like, I felt sick.
Yeah.
After that happened, because no one else knows, but they kind of all have a sense that something's wrong.
Well, they all had this function, right? And after they start feeling like they're making progress through the cube, they suddenly become very stratified. Kazan is obviously essential because he's able to crunch the numbers like that. Levin, same thing. She can do the math. Renz would have been very helpful, but he doesn't survive for very long. So when it comes to people like Worth and Holloway, who are perhaps among the more likable and compassionate characters to a certain extent, they're pretty expendable. And so is Quentin. Like, he's made himself the leader, and he'd like to frame himself as the one who can, you know, I can protect the rest of you, but who's going to protect us from you, type thing. And so there's an idea of who is essential and who is dead weight.
I thought the film did a really interesting job of juxtaposing two, not quite, but like civil servant jobs. You know, you have Quentin, the police officer, and Holloway, who's a doctor. And, you know, which one is more important when.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we kind of see that constantly. You know, the police are sometimes a very contentious force of protection in our world, but doctors are necessary to heal you when you're hurt. But do you deserve to be healed? Like, it starts to yield all these questions that arise in these really poignant human moments of like, shit, he's really hurt. I need to help him. No, you don't. He's dead weight.
That's right. And a point that you brought up when we were talking earlier, before we started recording, is that some of these roles are characterized by a certain stereotype. The fact that our doctor is a female, and females are traditionally understood as more compassionate. She's the one who wanted to bring Kazan along, so thank God for her. Otherwise, they wouldn't have realized that he could save the day, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the doctor, the woman, the healer, and then there's Quentin.
Yeah, and watching this film without, you know, too much expectation, I was watching it and I was like, okay, they're sending Quentin up to be the leader a little too early on.
Hmm.
And I was like, shit, I really hope this doesn't dissolve into like a angry black man trope. And then it did.
Yeah.
And that disappointed me within the film. It's not that it was a bad performance. I thought the actor really sold it. But in this kind of very white, heterosexual, cisgendered kind of world that this cube has with these people in it, to have, you know, the one person of color fall into these stereotypes. You know, he is a police officer, so he has issues with authority and exerting his own authority.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes up about like his kids and his wife, and I was just like, I feel less great about this. And then you have Levin, who is this math genius, and oh my gosh, she just put on glasses and now she can do more math. And the actress is very attractive, and you know, that felt a little bit worn to me. And then Kazan being, you know, basically, I'm air quotes again here, guys, the idiot savant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it, you know, the magical idiot. It just felt too easy. It felt too pat. And then, of course, you have, what's his nuts, the slacker white dude?
Worth,
that guy. In my opinion, isn't worth much. I'm kidding. But again, and these are not bad performances by these actors, but again, to have that kind of like nihilistic slacker dude who's just like, this doesn't matter, nothing matters, and then, oh no, I'm actually going to pull it out of nowhere.
Step up, yeah.
I feel like there's so much in this movie that's smarter than that.
Mm.
And it disappointed me. If I have one disappointment in this film, was that it kind of fell into those tropes. Again, we are looking at this, you know, 20 years on from Cube. You know, Cube was 97. We're now in 2017. And, oh, wow, I feel old now. But, you know, we are having different conversations about film now than we were then. So hindsight, 2020. But I did want to put that out there, that something that sits a bit off with me.
Yeah, it's a flaw.
You listen to me, woman. Every day I mop up after your bleeding heart. The only reason you even exist is because I keep you!
Something that a lot of people pick up on and has been written about extensively, but we should perhaps just mention in passing, is that these characters' names are named after prisons. Kazan is a prison in Russia. Levin and Worth make up Leavenworth Prison, which is in the U.S., San Quentin State Prison, Holloway Women's Prison, a penitentiary in France called Rennes. And then the first character, who I mentioned very briefly in my synopsis, his name is Alderson, played by Julian Richings, who we adore in this room, represents Alderson Federal Prison Camp, also in the USA. And did you catch the Resident Evil nod in that first kill?
Okay. I don't think it's a Resident Evil nod, because Resident Evil came out in like 2002.
Yeah, it nodded at Cube, I meant.
It's the reverse one. Yeah,
right.
That. Yeah.
Such a great gag.
I will never get sick of that gag.
No, that's probably half the budget of the film right there, but it worked.
Do you think we could build one of those?
One of those traps?
Like a trap that, like, slices someone into cubes or, like, lasers. I mean, between my theater degree and your sociology degree.
Oh, man, we'd be so fucked if we wound up in a cube.
Okay, real talk, guys. I'm still not sure what a prime number is.
A prime number is a number that can be, if you take the square root of it, that you can take a square root of it, I think.
Is it a number that can be divided only by itself in one?
Itself and what? I don't fucking know.
So, like, 3 can only be divided by, like, 3 and 1.
No, I don't think 3 is a prime number. I think 9 is, because you can take... Yeah, we would be totally fucked. And straight up, this is exactly why I don't like math, because who cares? Like, short of a cube, what does that knowledge get you?
Meanwhile, some hot girls, like, 5 cubes ahead of us, just being like, this is a prime number. Oh, my glasses.
This room moves to 0, 1, and negative 1 on the x-axis, 2, 5, and negative 7 on y, and 1, negative 1, and 0 on z.
What does that mean?
You suck at math.
This movie is a sociologist's wet dream for reasons Alex was just talking about. It's part of why I love zombie movies, is horror films that put human beings in a certain situation where they have to deal with each other, and the characters all relate to their personal standpoints within society. They don't just become ants in a maze. They all have their own standpoints and their own skills and their own perspectives that they have to navigate with one another. And what really struck me sociologically about this film was something that Worth says.
We're both part of the system. I drew a box, you walk a beat. It's like you said, Quentin, is keep your head down, keep it simple, just look at what's in front of you. I mean, nobody wants to see the big picture. Life's too complicated.
You keep everyone separated so the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Now, this is something that is implied in this film and something that's developed further in the terrible, terrible sequel that we might mention again, and we might not, because that'll do. But there's a sense that these characters all have a connection to the cube, that they all had something to do with the construction of it without knowing that their contribution would be put towards such a maniacal situation. It made me think of Karl Marx, as things do. Every single day I'm like, huh, Karl Marx. No. It made me think of the alienation of work and the depersonalization of labor. Now, Karl Marx had beef with capitalism for a variety of reasons, and one of them was how new cost-efficient work processes were alienating people, not only from work, but from each other. And it's like the assembly line model of production. So that's to say, if you're a toy maker, let's say, and you make trucks, back in the day, a toy maker oversees the construction of all the pieces, the assembly, the painting, and they feel a connection to the truck. They're like, I made this. I'm a toy maker and I make trucks. After the Industrial Revolution, a toy maker might find himself working in a toy factory making wheels all day. All day, every day, making just wheels. He feels no connection to his work. He feels no sense of pride at having created something. He's not making toys anymore. He's just a cog in the toy truck making machine. And technically, he's working with many others to achieve that goal, but they're not working together. They probably don't even know each other. So this de-skilling, as Marx termed it, had huge implications, not only for how people felt about work, but how they felt about themselves and how they felt about each other. Being able to have mastery over things, that's a very basic human need. It's not a biological need, but it's a sociological need. You need to feel like you have a talent and that you're contributing something and making use of that talent. And when human beings are alienated from one another, they stop giving a fuck about each other and it becomes harder for them to mobilize, which is why the big worker revolution that Marx predicted never fucking happened. Anyway, Marx was mostly concerned about workers being exploited, but what Cube offers us is a situation where the cogs of the machine are pretty much brought back together to work together to contribute to their own little specialization toward the common goal of escape. And that's a profound thing if you think about it. Like, I'm a perfectionist and I like to be in control of things, and I used to really hate group work when I was a student. I used to hate that so much because I wasn't in control. But now that I'm older, I welcome collaboration every chance I get because I'm more and more aware of my strengths and weaknesses and where someone else can fill that toward a more fulfilling goal.
When I was a kid, if I had to do a group project, I would just take all the work and do it myself, because I didn't trust anyone else to do it.
Yeah, I think I did that a fair bit too. Or I'd be like, I'll be the last person to look at it, and I would just kind of rewrite everything. Because seriously, did you ever have to do group work on an essay? That makes no sense. Like, how is that even a thing?
Well, it's weird. Like, you know, Andrea and I are both writers, but, you know, and being a writer is a very solitary thing. It's a deeply solitary thing. And the fact that we have this podcast to collaborate on, we've been able to build so much out of it. You know, it feels very different. Like, you know, the relationship Andrea and I have is not just, you know, really deep friendship. It's also a deep work commitment to each other. Like, anything one of us does affects the other, you know, and that good or bad. And that's, you know, something I think we're both kind of quietly cognizant of.
No, it's icky. Even the stuff I was just talking about, like when I was working in an office, you have to collaborate. You can't alienate yourself. It's bad for you and it's bad for the work and it's bad for this and that. But when I worked in a cube, it was get the fuck out of my cube, headphones on. I
got a cubicle. The place I work, which I love and is a terrific place to work, which I will not mention, but it's a great place to work. We have these pillars of our ethos, I guess.
Okay.
And they're just like on our walls all over our building. And one of them is collaboration. So sometimes I'll be in a really shitty meeting and I just look out the window into the hallway and I just see the word collaboration.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, fuck you.
You just think we should all collaborate on escaping here. We'll use your shoe and your shirt and...
Give me a button. Someone give me a goddamn button.
Need a button.
It's okay. I just swallowed my button.
I think even though Cube doesn't have a specific time that it takes place, and I think we can kind of comfortably say it's within the realm of modern times, and, you know, there's a big cube, it's, you know, everyone's kind of pontificating if it's, you know, a private corporation or a government ops thing, and, you know, that conversation goes on and on. But the other film, or film series rather, that Cube reminded me of and made me think about was the Saw franchise, which is not one we are off to talk about here, maybe one day, if you guys really want. But it made me think because it's, you know, Saw kind of bases itself, especially within its sequels, about this kind of game thing, the trap and the game that you have to escape if you're a good enough person, and do you sacrifice part of yourself to live, and then that feeds into your desire to live and not sit back in your life and do all that. And while it's not a direct parallel to Cube, I think there are some similarities, especially within some of the gore and the infighting and in the personalities who are involved in Cube. And I think what's very important, and I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast, but torture porn really came out of a post 9/11 era. It came out of a time of deep distrust in the American government, the way the government was running the Iraq war, the way it was, infiltrating other countries in the Middle East. And it just wasn't good. And so films like Saw, Hostel, even Human Centipede, some of those other ones, they all kind of feed into this paranoid delusion. And I think torture porn and Cube share some similar themes. So you've got these sort of innocent victims who are put in this place, but they have some kind of culpability. There are gruesome deaths. There is nihilistic imagery and endings and shifting alliances and identities. So people revealing themselves to be different than who they actually are. But of course, Cube was released and written and produced all well before 9/11, several years before. So in 1997, we're well smack into the middle of the 90s. And the 90s, as we are kind of resurfacing this nostalgia about it and how some of us came of age in it, the 90s are really interesting times, especially within North America and especially within America. And I feel like Cube, even though it's a Canadian film, tries to play into this kind of like, it could also be an American film. Don't worry about it, guys. But all of a sudden, at the beginning of the 90s, the Cold War just ended. And then everything was fine. And there were no big global conflicts in the 90s. And that's when it all kind of became about the internal turmoil. You know, you have things like the LA riots, the O.J. Simpson trial, the Anita Hill hearings, Columbine, all of these things that were happening were all internal. So it was like once all the global conflicts had kind of gotten quiet for a little bit, all of the internal issues arose. And I think Cube actually speaks to that because there is no, like, there's not a jigsaw plotting out how you should really seize control of your life. This is a random thing. And the longer these guys are in the Cube and they're just fighting their way through it, the more they have to come to terms with themselves. And I think, you know, even through the 90s, especially now, we are offered so many distractions to distract ourselves from ourselves. So if you actually need to sit and work on yourself, you have to make a conscious decision to do that. Mm-hmm. And so it almost feels like an extreme form of therapy to be in the Cube.
Sure. That
you're forced to confront yourself and you get tired and you get hungry and all those social niceties and decorum just get stripped away and then you're left with who you are. And I think Quentin is an interesting example of that because he kind of mentions, you know, oh, I don't get to see my kid very much and, you know, me and my wife aren't together and all these little things. And then it kind of comes out how dark that story is. Mm-hmm. It's not just like, oh, we broke up and I don't get to see my kid as much as I'd like to. It's, he has far more to do with it than he lets on.
That's right. And it's Holloway who figures it out, too. It's not like he suddenly reveals it. She just starts seeing these flares of temper and puts the pieces together.
No wonder your wife left you. All that bottled up anger. And a thing for young girls.
And I think that's a thing, the longer you're with someone and, you know, the more you know them. And I as we've talked about on this podcast, I don't think you can ever fully know another person. I'm not sure if we even can ever fully know ourselves. But it becomes this thing where, you know, in the midst of almost dehydration, no food, exhaustion, mental exhaustion, you're left with who you truly are. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's a really scary place to be. So another element that came out of another interview with Vincenzo Natali, and again, I have not met the man, but he seems incredibly smart and articulate and gives really good interviews.
He's cute. He's a good-looking man. What?
Okay. In another interview I was reading with Vincenzo Natali with the website Film Freak Central, which we will link in the show notes, because it's a really interesting interview. He was doing it, I think, on the release of Splice, but they do talk about Cube and Natali's own kind of ethos when it comes to filmmaking. Natali kind of shies away from saying he's directly influenced by the novelist Franz Kafka, but does mention him as like something he's really interested in. So in my undergrad, my minor was in English literature and then kind of general literature. And so I did get to read some Kafka. Hmm. It's depending on the translation, pretty good.
Okay.
Pretty good. There are always dudes outside with weird beards that they could never fully grow in, chain smoking and like rambling on about like the metamorphosis and like...
That's all I know is kind of the surface level that it's about a guy who turns into a bug.
But my favorite of Kafka's work was The Trial, which is about a man who is kind of going about, again, it's been a little while, guys, but it's about a guy who's just been going through his everyday life and then all of a sudden is apprehended by the police and put on trial. No one ever tells him what his crime is or how it's all going to work, and it's just this, like, horrible bureaucracy thing that he's put through. Mm. So Kafka is a bit of, gosh, you can call him so many things. There is so much scholarship on him, but for the sake of this, let's call him an existential nihilist. And he was someone who was really interested in power in society and the way power was manipulated and corrupted. He was also really interested in kind of a broken down vocabulary, like the way people don't actually communicate, or if you try to communicate and it's not heard. Mm. So there's tons of interesting themes in there. And he really wrote about chaotic worlds, which don't have any true moral code or any real lesson. You know, it's just this kind of, again, it's that nihilism. It's just these things are fucked up and they happened. And he deals with them on a really metaphorical level. And another thing he was really interested in was the notion of the lack of relationship between human law and divine law. So the notion of the laws that we as humans create, like, don't kill. If you kill, you'll get put on trial. Don't steal. All of that kind of stuff. But, you know, divine law is something bigger. It's something better. It's like from God. And that we were never able to kind of fully synthesize those two things. So they're kind of constantly at odds with each other. And I think you see that still to this day when you have people who are really aligned with their religion, not upholding a kind of societal law. And this discrepancy is at the heart of so many of Kafka's characters, and they create the sense of absurdity and, again, the lack of morals. And I thought it was interesting that the downfall of these people in the cube is not due to their lack of skills. It's not due to their lack of worthiness within society. Mm. It's due to their own personal defaults. So kind of as you were mentioning, Andrea, with Marx and the valuing of skills over commonality and working together and that collaboration, you know, the skills have become such a big part of their identity that they can't escape them. Mm-hmm. And they feel beholden to them in a way. And I think that's kind of where a lot of the character clashes come from, because what is their will to survive? Mm-hmm. And some people, it's kind of about their job and their station in life. And some people, it's just they want to get out of there. They're almost a little scared straight. That's kind of what I feel with Worth. Like, he's pushed and he's pushed and he's kind of sitting back and he's just kind of going along and just kind of saying shitty things and being annoying. And then right towards the end, he decides he wants to live. And he decides maybe he actually kind of cares about Levin.
Yeah. That's how I interpreted it, as he cared about her enough to want her to live. I think out of all of them, he felt the most culpable for where he was.
And the fact that they both die.
Yeah.
They're both dying in the space of this cube, this unknowable cube, this unresolvable thing between our profession and the skills we have and who we truly are. Mm. Those are the themes and the elements that really stuck with me. And again, I feel like maybe that's why some people don't glom onto this film, is because it just ends with this bright white light, and the character who is the least able to articulate his thoughts and feelings is the one that gets to ascend. He gets to leave the cube.
That's right.
Rightfully so, because without him, they wouldn't have made it. But
at the same time, he shouldn't have made it without them, because they needed him.
It feels like a big kind of fuck you to the audience in a way, if you want to take it like that. But then it's also just a bit like, do you really want to know what's outside of this?
I loved the ending.
I like to think I'm that vengeful.
Oh, I would be. Hell yeah. Take you with me.
Me personally?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fair.
We're dying together. You know that, right?
Yeah. Whoever of us is getting buried with the other one.
Exactly. And we both know who that's going to be.
But yeah, that's Cube. That's this ballsy, strange film, which I think succeeds more often than it fails.
I think so. I think it's charming. I like the pace. There's laughs interspersed. There's surprises. There's suspense. And the ambiguity I was really fine to go along with. But I guess some people weren't, because they decided to make another couple of films, which Natalie was not involved in the slightest. And you can tell.
Yeah, full disclosure, I tried to watch both of them. There's Cube 2 Hypercube.
It's like Cube squared. Yeah. Like the 2 is lethal, because that's so crazy. Hypercube is bananas. It's crazy. I feel like it does everything wrong what Cube did right. It was such a perfect inversion of Cube, in that the rooms had no color. They were really white and sterile, and yet you had the characters in their plain clothes. So, like, that was kind of enough of a discrepancy just to be like, what's happening? You're building off the first one, but also kind of ignoring it.
You can tell so much about someone from their clothes.
It's a tell.
It's one of the easiest ways to determine class, interests, anything like that. Like, I still fucking look like I work at the Gap.
She does.
And I'm okay with that. And so, like, for both of the sequels, I tried to watch them, and I got about 20 minutes into both before I was just like, I can't. Like,
yeah.
I physically couldn't watch them.
So Hypercube, they're in a Hypercube, basically. They're in another exact same situation, except there's another dimension to their peril, such that they can enter a room and time will be slowed or quickened, or gravity will be a bit different. So they try to explain it. The pseudoscience is fucked. And it was also really strangely shot. There were very strange perspectives. There was a strange sense of humor that I just couldn't get on board with. It was totally, completely off. I think the only thing I liked about Hypercube was there was a character who was like Quint. He's a guy who at first he seemed to be really, you know, like a leader, like a born leader, and he's powerful. And no, I guess actually he comes right off as a dick. But anyway, he gets hungry and he finds a character and attacks him, and it's implied that he eats him. And then he finds that character again, because this hypercube has like multiple dimensions going on, and he eats him again. And the guy's name is Jerry. So for fans out there of Parks and Rec, Alex got me into Parks and Rec, and I'm obsessed with it. So he's going through the hypercube eating Jerry's.
Oh my God, Jerry, when you check your email, you go to Alta Vista and type please go to yahoo.com?
Well, how else would I do it?
You don't have your email bookmarked? Do you have any bookmarks?
What's bookmarks?
God, Jerry, you don't deserve the internet.
So I rewatched that one recently to see if it shone anything of value on our discussion of the first one, and it does not. It has a far more conclusive ending where there is a survivor, and it's 100% a military experiment, and the survivor gets shot. So there is a sense of nihilism, but there's also too much explained, in my opinion. As for Cube Zero, I think I saw it years ago, but it's completely removed from the labyrinthine environment into like an office. It's supposed to be like behind the scenes of the people who make Cube, and there's like a mysterious character who has a fancy cane.
Like Andre Lenoge from Storm of the Century?
I don't know what that is, but you in the 20
Stephen
minutes you
King, man.
Storm of the Century is Stephen King?
Yeah, man.
No, I don't know. In the 20 minutes you saw, you didn't see the guy with the cane?
I think I just kind of like blacked out.
Yeah.
I don't remember it.
Okay. But coming back to Splice, which I saw many years later, the similarity that I had a feeling we might circle back to is the sterility of science against the organicness of human nature, and the paucity of my English today. Holy fuck.
So that's Cube. That is this big labyrinthine thing that had a couple other sequels that followed it, which I don't know. I don't know anyone who's a fan of them.
No.
And I mean, if you are, good on you. I couldn't do it. But I think Cube is a really special experimental film that came out well before so many other things that kind of ape on similar themes or even similar imagery, as we were just talking about with Resident Evil.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that means that a director and a filmmaker and a creative team hits on something at the right time in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And it found an audience despite all odds. And I truly believe this about the film industry. The film industry can be such a shitty fucking place, and it can play so many stupid fucking games, But if your product is good, there are means with which an audience will find it. You know, I think we're seeing this a little bit right now with the resurgence of Jennifer's Body, which is really exciting because I love that movie. And, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff out there. And I think Cube has kind of found its place and it's found its fans. And even though I would consider it a cult film, this was one of the films that when we said we were going to do it, you guys got really excited about. And that makes me really happy because despite the issues I have with it, I'm really happy it exists. I think it does so much so well so simply. And I think with a clear concept, a good team, you can do so much.
Yeah. And for those of you who haven't heard of it, I was excited to do this episode for another Pontypool-like situation where this is a Canadian gem. It's a part of our heritage as Canadian horror fans, and I'm happy to recommend it to anybody. Guess we've got some announcements now. Well, first of all, we'd like to thank everybody who picked up our Class of 2017 t-shirt. We did something a little bit different this year where we hired an external artist, and I think she did an amazing job. The artwork's really cool. The sales were good, and I'm really grateful for the support.
Yeah, so those t-shirts should be getting shipped out very, very soon. Mm-hmm. So keep an eye on your doorstep. If you weren't able to get on them this year, hopefully we'll do it again next year. We'll see. And then in terms of another announcement, this one is from me. My second book is now available for pre-order.
Yay!
And it is called The 1990s Teen Horror Cycle, Final Girls and a New Hollywood Formula. So this was a book and a topic and a subject and a theme and an issue and all of those things that all kind of mean the same thing that I've been really interested in for a long time. And there isn't a shit ton of scholarship about these films as a whole. So I'm talking about everything from the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie up until, you know, Final Destination and Cherry Falls up in 2000 and what this teen horror cycle meant. And there's not always a lot of love for it in the horror community.
No, there's the opposite. There's a lot of unwarranted derision.
And I think what's been cool is the bits that I have announced about it. And so if you follow us on social media, you probably heard about the book. There seem to be some people who are pretty excited about this topic getting some ink spilt on it. And I'm really excited to share this book. So it is available for pre-order. I worked again with McFarland Books, who I did the New French Extremity book with. We'll put that link for pre-order in the show notes if you are so interested. And yeah, I believe it's getting its release towards the end of the year. So keep an eye out for that. Maybe there will be a Faculty of Horror episode on it.
Ooh la la.
Who knows? But, you know, I do know it's a slightly expensive book because it is slightly academic. If you can't afford the book, what you can do is request it at your local library. And I've been seeing my first book pop up in library systems all around, and it's super cool.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Another book that we should perhaps mention coming out at the end of the year is Alex and I both contributed to Spectacular Optical's new release called Yuletide Terror, and it's all about holiday books. And so that one actually, God, when did we write that? Like last winter. Yeah, it's there's a lot of contributors and there's a lot of work went into it. So it's crowdfunding right now. And I have to say that the perks and the prizes and the stuff that you can get for pre-ordering with the Kickstarter are pretty cool. So we'll link that in the show notes as well. Alex wrote a paper on P2 and I wrote about the children. So if you'd like to read what we had to say about those, pick that one up as well.
And of course, last mention of it, Salem Horror Fest. We're going to be there in October. Super excited. Again, all the links in the show notes. Check it out. If everything goes well with recording and what we talk about, hopefully that live episode will be hitting our podcast feed at some point.
At some point. It won't be next month's episode. Next month's episode, we have something else planned. And it's something, again, that we have been planning forever.
I literally have been talking to you about this since we started.
I know.
And you didn't want to do it.
Really?
You were just always kind of like, I don't want to do it.
Okay. Then I don't want to do it.
But I finally broke her, guys, because when someone writes a book on a topic, we should probably fucking talk about that topic, shouldn't we, Andrea?
I guess.
So, not only is this a topic that at least one of us has some incredible expertise on and insight, but it's also really big in the horror community, and it's also a bit sadly relevant, given some recent circumstances. And again, we have talked about this for a while, and because it's October, it's our Halloween episode, You know us, we go big or we go home, and we never go home. So we're going to be doing the original Night of the Living Dead trilogy. So that is Night of the Living Dead. That is Dawn of the Dead. That is Day of the Dead.
That's it.
We're doing it.
We're going to do them. Yes. The passing of George Romero is hugely felt by the horror community, particularly here in Toronto. We'll talk a little bit more next episode about that. But yeah, these are tremendously influential films. And we are, of course, aware that there are more films to the franchise after the fact. We'll maybe mention those. Suffice it to say that these three films are so hugely packed with themes and ideas and scholarship. We have plenty to talk about with just those three.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to talk about that. And people were tweeting us and messaging us, like, after Romero passed. You guys going to do something
like tribute episode?
And we planned this for an October episode at the beginning of this year. So, yeah, it's a little sad that it's so timely. But, you know, these are incredible films and they deserve to be celebrated. So we're going to do our bit to celebrate them in our favorite month of the year.
So let's bust out of this cube. What do you say? What's the square root of 4,894?
Oh, fuck me. 9.
Oh, God. I think we're going to be here a while, guys. So until next time.
Office hours are closed.
Children behave. That's what they say when we're together. And watch how you play. They don't understand.